Hello, and welcome to episode 23 of Attention Engineer. I'm Laura Kidd, a music producer, songwriter, and solo artist making music as Penfriend. Find me around the internet at Penfriend Rocks and say hello sometime. In a noisy online world, the gift of someone's attention is priceless. So thank you for joining me on my mission to inspire creativity in every listener through having the conversations I've always hoped for with some of the artists I admire the most. Greetings from the Launchpad, where I'm recovering after a stressful day. Do you ever have days when absolutely everything you do goes wrong? One thing after another? To be honest, I'm just relieved to be home. I'm recovering after a stressful afternoon where my elderly pooch, Mr. Benji, decided to run away during our afternoon walk in the park. It's really lucky I've been working on my fitness so much recently, though I was also using the walk to break in some brand new Doc Martens, so it was all a bit uncomfortable and sweaty, to be honest. Obviously, the most important thing is that he's fine. And if you can hear heavy breathing, by the way, that's him. He's snoozing pretty heavily on the chair near my desk. He's fine. On the way home from the park, I found myself surrounded by crowds of parents and kids from the local school, all of whom seemed to be insinuating that lockdown is a figment of my imagination. I'm never leaving my house again. And why would I, when my beautiful leopard print furry slipper boots have just danced into my life? Wherever in the world you are, and whether you're locked down, quarantined, or neither, I hope you're getting through this okay. Sometimes I am, and sometimes I'm not. And I think it's important to say that. Now, speaking of leopard print, it's time for today's guest. Propelled by the Manic Street Preachers lyric, Libraries Gave Us Power, the anchoress, aka Welsh producer and multi-instrumentalist Catherine Ann Davies, is a voracious devourer of words and music. From her early roots as a classically trained flautist to her current obsession with vintage synthesizers, Davies has spent much of the last 4 years developing her writing and engineering skills to become one of the most interesting up-and-coming songwriters and producers in the UK, and has collaborated with a variety of artists including the London Philharmonic, Nitin Sawhney, Ed Harcourt, Bernard Butler, Liam Howe, and Paul Statham. The second anchoress album, The Art of Losing, will be released in March 2021. Here we go. Please, could you introduce yourself?
I could. My name's Catherine, and I make music. Or rather, more accurately, I should say I make records, which is quite old-fashioned. So that means that I work as a producer, a co-writer, and I also have my own artist project, which is called The Anchoress.
And I was trying to remember when we had first met, and I think it was 2010 at Ladyfest.
Was it?
Yeah.
God.
And then you invited me to play with you the following year at Strongroom Bar, which is a really cool gig. There were far more people at Strongroom than there were at Ladyfest.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. Yeah. So,
we've all played those gigs where you're kind of like, What I've really enjoyed is seeing you just keep at it, because one of my favourite quotes is that it takes a long time to become an overnight success.
I love that quote too.
Yeah. I really appreciate all the hard work you've been putting in.
Oh, thank you. I think it is such a myth, isn't it? That kind of overnight success, whereas I kind of think of it as sheer bloody mindedness. It's like, I just keep doing what I do, and suddenly people are having this completely different reaction to something that I've always been doing. And it's funny, actually, because we just had the collaborative album that I made with Bernard Butler came out last month. And the really interesting thing about it is we've had this record for so long, and so many people were not interested in it. And then it's exactly the same songs, it's exactly the same material, exactly the same recordings. And suddenly people are, and it's lovely that people are really enjoying it and have lots of lovely things to say about it. But there's a small part of you that just thinks, you know, 7 years ago when we started doing this, no one gave a flying fuck about this. Mm-hmm. And it's strange. The music industry is so odd in that regard that you can just be doing the same thing just at the wrong time or in front of the wrong people. And it makes you realise that it's got very little to do with the quality of your work and lots of luck and just a whole load of random factors. That So keep on keeping on.
I think the perseverance part is bigger than all of it. I feel the same way. I've started describing it as a war of attrition recently. It's like, I don't care if the whole world doesn't care about my music. I'm going to keep making it. And I'm going to keep making it. And eventually someone might open the door at the tiniest crack. And because I'm a child, I'll probably go, no, I'm all right. Just keep doing it myself because I don't care. All I want to do is make music.
Yeah, the irony is that you built your own empire in the meantime. It means you don't actually need access to all those doors that maybe people were knocking on 5 years ago. The music industry's changed so much now that actually you don't want to be signed to a label anymore. You don't want that publishing deal. But everything we were told, you know, back in 2011 when you and I were kind of starting out is not true anymore. And I love that.
Yeah, I love that too.
It's exciting and it's freeing.
It really is. So tell me more about this collaborative album, because we heard Bernard Butler talking about it last week in my podcast, and I'd love to get your perspective on it.
Well, we started making it. I thought we started making it in 2010, but Bernard tells me that we've got a very early writing session, I think from 2009, but to be honest, I'm not going to get bogged down in the dates. We had kind of been put together by one of those kind of apocryphal record company types to just see what happened if we did some writing together. And I think it very quickly became kind of evident that we weren't doing the kind of music that they were expecting. Mm. He wrote, I think, about 3 or 4 songs in a week that we both really liked. And then kind of nothing really happens with it. It kind of got caught up in that whole, like, corporate side of the music industry that isn't really interested in taking risks or doing interesting things. And we just kind of, I guess we sort of sporadically kept in touch. And then we ended up going back in, I think it was 2014, early 2015, and we wrote another kind of 4 or 5 songs. I just decided we were going to kind of finish the record under our own steam, really. There'd never been that kind of big push, I don't think, to get it out there or try and get it signed or anything. I think Bernard had played it to some people, but, and, you know, people had heard songs here and there, but it was just one of those things where it was always, we'd both kind of occasionally text each other and go, oh yeah, listen to those songs again. Aren't they great? Oh, it's such a shame that no one else is ever going to hear them. And then I think it was last year, Pete Perfides, who runs the label Needle Mythology, him and Bernard live quite close to each other and they'd kind of bumped into each other. And Needle Mythology, the whole ethos of their label is about putting out lost albums. And I think Pete just kind of decided that this was a lost album, even though it never actually had any release at all, that it was something that kind of fitted under the umbrella of what Needle Mythology is about. And yeah, so it finally came out, you know, practically almost 10 years after we started it, which is mad. But also, if you know anything about the music industry, as you do, not that mad, because it's a messed up place.
Yeah. I'm glad it came out at all, because I think there's a lot of really good music that doesn't, like you say, it just gets trapped in this sort of weird Kafkaesque corridor situation where, like, you just need a champion to or someone, I don't know, someone to see it in a different light perhaps, because I suppose either of you could have put it out, you could have put it out 5 years ago under your own steam as well, but that thing where you needed that person to come in and open that door almost, or open that door in your mind.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it could have been an option to kind of self-release it. I mean, but I was so kind of, I was so busy with Simple Minds from like 2014 onwards, that kind of took over my life and I didn't really have the energy and time to self-release anymore.
Yeah,
I didn't have to because the Anchoress was signed to a label. And I think it's just like, you know, Bernard likes, I wouldn't want to speak for him, put words in his mouth, but he likes making records. I don't think he has any interest in setting up a label and doing all of that side of things. But it really is just what I was talking about, that moment of luck or the right time. That Pete suddenly heard it and thought, do you know what, actually I like this and want to put it out. And and just a shame, not a shame, because I'm so glad it's Pete that put it out and it was just meant to be. It was, I think patience is a virtue in the music industry, rather than I think there's always a lot of like hurry up and kind of get on with it and capitalize on your momentum, but my experience of it is just take your time and things will unravel as they're supposed to.
That's very good advice. So what's it like making an album over a period of years? I've never done that. It sounds really interesting. It sounds like maybe it's kind of like a fine wine. sort of situation?
Well, it was kind of more an album in two parts, really. As I say, we kind of had that those kind of first sessions and that first flurry of almost like the first half of the record. And then I think we only did another 4 or 5 days. I think in total, we probably sat in a room together 15 days max, I think, at most. And everything else was just kind of done, you know, back and forth with mixes over email. I remember being on Simple Minds tour bus and, you know, Bernard sending me stuff where he'd lay down guitar on like No More Tears to Cry, or he'd change something in Judas, and we'd just be back and forth on email. So it was nice to have the space and no pressure of anyone kind of going, oh, we need it by this date because it's got to go out. It was just really, I always describe making that record as a bit like a holiday, because it's nothing like what I've done with Yankaress, where I'm a total control freak and I don't really want anyone else to be doing anything without me kind of hovering over their shoulder. Whereas this felt like a collaboration in the true sense, and that I, you know, deeply respect Bernard's abilities and track record, and was able to kind of just let him do what he does, and then he let me do what I do that he doesn't do, and we kind of complemented each other. It kind of dovetailed in the middle of somewhere. It was, yeah, like a lovely holiday that was very protracted.
That sounds like a dream collaboration, really. Being respected by the other person and then just being able to add your stuff.
I think it's also just nice for me when I'm, and I know you get this too because of how you work, when you take everything on your shoulders normally for your own artist projects, to actually just have somebody else to kind of take a little bit of that load off is really lovely. Yeah. And even in the promotion of the record, it's been really nice too, knowing that, you know, oh, if we were to get a bad review, it's not just me that it's going to kind of come down on, that, you know, he would be equally kind of invested in people enjoying the record and liking the songs. And I've never been in a band, so I don't know what that feels like, but I imagine it's a bit like that.
Yeah, hopefully sharing the work.
He did way more work than I did on that record, you know, huge amount more in terms of the finessing and tweaking. And it was like I say, it was lovely to just take a back seat for once.
Yeah, that sounds good. I'm interested in your use of the term control freak as someone who is exactly as you just described. So I was interested to hear more about your second solo record, your second Yankaress album that's just been announced, and the pre-order's up now, so please everyone go check that out. You said The Art of Losing wasn't a fun record to make, and I can really relate to that, having just not just because of, you know, the themes and the stuff my songs are also about, but because it basically is sitting in a room on your own for quite a long time, producing, engineering, performing. Do you think there's a misconception that making music is meant to be a great big barrel of laughs in some way?
Yeah, again, maybe it comes back to this idea of, I've never been in a band, so I don't know what that feels like. You know, the name of the Yankaress itself is a kind of in-joke, talking about that kind of solo endeavour, that kind of hermit-like existence. For me, if I didn't enjoy making music, I'd be worried. Obviously, the overall cumulative experience is one that I adore and am deeply passionate about. I think probably what I was talking about there was more about kind of the personal circumstances and things that were happening and challenges in my life over the past 4 years that have been personally horrendous. And I think it was hard not for that to impact upon my feelings around making the record, that it felt more like a battle to get it done. And at points, not to be too blunt about it, a battle to get it done in case I died. And that was really difficult for me. And it's quite a hard record for me to listen back to as well, because music is such a powerful, evocative force. I feel as if I'm dragged back into that time when I listen to it. So it's going to be challenging to play it live, I think, as well, because I don't really want to dwell in those days particularly. I don't remember what your question was, though.
It was a very jumbled one, really. I just find it so interesting partly because I'm so independent. Like, there seems very little point in making music that's not very real. And I think I'd feel like that anyway, regardless. So I totally relate to what you're saying about that sort of dwelling on something when you come back to listen. And my new album I've just finished is about a lot of really difficult stuff. And it really helped me get through that stuff, actually. It really helped me day to day now be dealing with things that would have just sort of lingered around. So it's that nice way of crystallizing my thoughts about that thing, almost getting over it a bit more. So for me, it's a very cathartic thing. And then I do start to wonder, one, if and when I can tour it, how am I going to feel? And two, it's all very well me putting, you know, writing a song about my own death and then releasing it. But does there need to kind of be a content warning for people? So I'm just like, by the way, this is really fucking sad. So maybe sit down the first time you listen to it or something. So I start thinking about that kind of thing before people have heard my record. Do you think about that kind of stuff?
I do. I mean, there's one song on the new record called 5 AM that I wasn't sure I was going to put on the album.
Yeah.
And I'd kind of rather not explain the song because I'd rather people listen to it and then they will understand why I had some reticence about sharing it. Mm-hmm. It was something I'd written a while ago, never to share. And then it kind of made itself known that it really wanted to be on the record. And I'm still quite nervous about it. Obviously people won't hear that till March, so I've got some time to kind of get used to it. It's interesting actually, because I've been thinking a lot about how we talk about trauma and how we share that whilst retaining boundaries at the same time, because I've been reading a lot of amazing memoirs during lockdown about awful things that have happened in people's lives and just how that can be navigated in a way that is maybe classy isn't the right word, but is safe and still allows you to have, you know, some space of privacy, I think, as well. And I think as artists, we shouldn't kind of get dragged into this idea that our lives are there to be consumed by our fans or listeners completely and totally, that you are allowed to have some boundaries, that you don't owe anyone the complete details of your trauma. And that you are allowed to share part of that, and it doesn't have to be everything. You want to hold something back for yourself. It's a really tricky balance, and I'm not saying that I've got it right, and I go back and forth on it every day. And I guess when the Art of Losing comes out, that will be the moment when I kind of realise whether I have got that balance right.
Yeah.
Because once it's out in the world, you can't take it back.
No. I have no problem putting all of the details and all of the honesty and everything into my work. But like you were saying about explaining or potentially over-explaining a song, especially before someone's heard it, like, I don't think I would want to do that. So I'm probably not going to introduce that song as, this is a song, listen out for the middle bit where I basically describe what I think my own death's going to be like. But interestingly, I shared that song, a version of that song online the other week with my correspondence club. And that was the one people were emailing me about and saying, thank you for that song, because it did something, because it's so honest and very brutally honest. I guess it just did something. And that's what songs can do, isn't it? They allow the listener to bring their own feelings and experience. It's not really about specific thing that happened to the writer. It becomes something much bigger. And like you say, you can't take that back once it's out in the world.
Yeah, I always used to say that I thought that as musicians or artists, you were kind of like a kind of shaman figure, that your job is to be the conduit through which other people can express their experiences and feelings that maybe they don't have the words or tools to directly express themselves, and you're kind of an intermediary. And I think that's quite a helpful way to think about it. So basically, it's not all about you, it's about the listeners.
Yeah.
And reflecting back their experiences and allowing them space within the songs to see themselves as well. I hope.
Yeah, that's a really nice way of putting it. So do you have a mission in your music career?
Oh, that's a really good question. I guess so, but partly because of the music that moved and changed me. I don't think it's any secret by now that I'm a huge Manic Street Preachers fan. I didn't only grow up listening to them, I would say I kind of dragged myself up listening to them. You know, I'm the first person in my family to go to university to have A-levels because of that band. And I think a lot of that has rubbed off on me, that sense that music needs to do more than just entertain. I think it's so difficult to talk about it without sounding as if you've got some kind of like high and mighty ideas about yourself. But it's only in that sense of a mission, maybe, to just do some good in the world beyond just a song that people can shout along to when they're drunk. That's great too, but I would like to open up worlds, I guess, to people that might feel that it doesn't belong to them, like I did when I was growing up. You know, I felt like there wasn't many opportunities, and then books and films and all those things that the Manics introduced me to made me think, you know what, maybe I can have a different life to the one that everyone tells me I'm supposed to have. So maybe it's that. And also to talk about uncomfortable things as well. Certainly a big part of my audience is male. And I know that I talk about things and shed light on issues that are perhaps uncomfortable for men, because I'm often talking about the patriarchy. The patriarchy, you know, capital letters. But you know, that I guess explaining my experience in the world as a woman, and sometimes that's uncomfortable. I've had a few kind of fractious exchanges over the years, even with journalists or fans who have written about me or used language in a certain way, and then I've pointed out to them, I hope politely but firmly, why that's not okay.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I see that as part of my mission, but that's just me being honest about who I am and how I would be with anybody that I met. And I don't see any difference with the people that interact with my music as well.
Mm-hmm. I think that makes a massive difference. You also have a podcast called The Art of Losing.
I do, yes. Well, I started it when the album was originally supposed to come out last year. But for, you know, lots of boring reasons, it kind of got postponed, and then the pandemic happened. So I'd started kind of doing the podcast as, I guess, like an accompanying, I don't know, journey. Yeah. Maybe exploring some of the themes a little bit deeper that are on the record, and just, you know, accompanying conversations for those that kind of wanted to find out a little bit more about what I was interested in, what I'd been thinking about. And I'm just about to start recording season two of that.
Very cool.
So that's quite exciting. Yeah. And I had some wonderful conversations with like David Bowie's producer, Mario Minolti, talking about making the lost David Bowie record. So this is the theme.
Nice.
I'm trying to think. We talked about the poetry of grief and loss with Patrick Jones, Nicky Wire's brother. That was an amazing conversation that I had with him at his house. We had Kat Lister talking about young widowhood, which was a really, really moving conversation. And so incredibly brave of her to agree to come on and talk about losing her husband, Pat Long. And then I had a very, very frank conversation with a good friend of mine, Sophie Daniels, about baby loss and our experiences of that ourselves in our lives. So, you know, not a happy sunshine podcast, but I think really, you know, having some really important conversations about things that people haven't tended to talk about, but I really see such a shift now and such a change where these are becoming topics that we don't shy away from anymore. So my work is done and I don't need to do another season, basically. That's it. It's job done.
Yeah. I think podcasts and more independent music and stuff can really open up these conversations in an interesting way, because these things affect everyone, you know. And people, I don't think people are listening to podcasts to have some happy, jolly experience. And people certainly, no offense, they're not listening to your music to have a happy, jolly experience. And neither are they listening to my music to have a happy, jolly experience. I think everyone's well aware that that's not what we're dealing in. So I just love the fact that you want to explore things in different ways. And I think the art of conversation is something that needs to be protected and supported and encouraged. And that's what I'm trying to do with this as well, you know, obviously.
Yeah, I think it was a way of me explaining things to myself as well. It was also kind of dipping my toe in the water of what we talked about earlier, you know, any trepidation that I might have about releasing the album and kind of putting that out in the public domain, and testing that out by having those conversations with people that I trusted, people that I knew were very eloquent about those experiences. So, yeah, maybe it's partly a little rehearsal for the album release.
Yeah, get your talking like points say, in order.
Well, everything works out in the way that it does for a reason, you know. And at the time, I was hugely frustrated that the album got delayed. But actually, I look back at it now and think, do you know what? It's the best possible thing that could have happened, because I no longer burst into tears when I talk about certain things or someone brings up a topic. I've got that distance on it now. I am able to approach certain subjects in a way that is being kind to myself. And I don't think I could have done that a year ago, 18 months ago. It's a lot of therapy, a lot of EDMR, post-traumatic stress therapy, trauma therapy, etc. That in the same way that the Bernard record came out when it was supposed to come out, as I call it, the Bernard record, CADBB, or
yes.
IMOMF, in memory of my feelings. I also now kind of believe that The Art of Losing, second Anchoress album, is going to come out at the time it was supposed to come out, and that will be the right time.
Yeah.
Despite my lack of patience, probably then.
I feel the same about mine. I basically had written an entire album and recorded half of it last year, last summer, and then went on tour and things and ended my old project and everything. But I was really frustrated not to just have it finished because I just would have loved to put it out this year. And then actually it's become such a more interesting and deep piece of work because of the time for reflection. And so you said earlier, I can't remember exactly how you phrased it, but the idea that we can get a little bit caught up in, or we can sound like we're caught up in the sort of grand importance of what we do as musicians, songwriters, artists and things. Because it's hard to talk about those things without sounding basically incredibly arrogant. But when I allow myself to think about things in what might be perceived as an arrogant way by people who don't understand or whatever, I do think that part of what I do as a songwriter is a kind of philosophy. So I read and I watch things and I listen to things and I take it all in and I process it through my experience and I try to be very honest about my experiences and put those into my work in the way that someone who, yeah, wants to, I don't know, transmit that to others or share that with others would do for a meaningful, what's the word, exchange, for a meaningful result. Like you say, I'm not making music just so people can sing along if they are drunk. But I guess that's nice. That's cool. But it has to be more than that because music has always been more than that for me as well. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. I think it's about that meaningful exchange, isn't it? But I'm really also interested in this idea of authenticity, though, because I also think as a culture, we are so hung up on the idea of artists being authentic or diaristic or confessional. Mm. And ironically, what has been a massive shift for me is on the first Anchoress record was being really obsessed with the idea of false confessions and kind of fictive persona characters, not being able to separate the truth from fiction. That was something that I played with through the whole record. And then here I am having made a second record that is a little bit like the kind of confessional writing that I was very much kind of pulling away from. And I've kind of had to ask myself, well, why is that? And I remember a conversation I had with Tori Amos probably about 6 years ago about this, which was about how women as songwriters are often denigrated. When female songwriters are confessional, we talk about them as if it's an easy process, as if there's no skill involved in that, as if we're just vomiting up the words. Which again is where I took the cover art, The Art of Losing, is kind of a play on that, where I'm holding a book of pages that I've kind of vomited up.
Yeah.
And the inference being that there is no skill involved in that. Whereas if you look at the way male songwriters tend to be talked about when they put their heart on their sleeve and translate their life into song, and the amount of critical validation that gets. I think there's a lot of corollaries if you look at sort of fine art as well and the visual arts in that regard, that women are often expected to just write in a certain way or and that it's not work almost, it's just kind of, it falls out of them.
Oh yeah, I mean, I get very, very, very fucking angry when people dismiss my music as, oh, it's just like reading someone's diary. Because I'm sorry, yes, I write in my diary every day, it takes about 10 minutes. I created a whole world of music, you know, arranged every single note, recorded it, you know, had it mixed by someone who's incredibly talented. That's not a diary entry. That's far beyond a diary entry. And I think that speaks to what you're saying. And I remember that. I remember that it was an interview, isn't it, that you did with Tori?
Yeah.
I remember reading that and exactly that thing really stuck out to me. And I remember thinking quite deeply about it and just thinking, actually, I want to write honest music and I'm not going to let the world's perception or potential perception of that as being easy or whatever stop me from actually still saying things that matter to me, you know, and I've fought through that. But I also decided not to sit there with an acoustic guitar and a flowery dress on and present my songs in that manner. And no offense to anyone who's decided to do that, but I decided not to because I knew that with what I was trying to do, that would just send the wrong message and it would all get very confused. So I totally understand and appreciate what you're saying there. Yeah,
it's so difficult, isn't it? Because I'm certain, I know we kind of said at the beginning we weren't going to end up having a conversation about being a woman in music, and look what we're talking about.
I wouldn't ask the question. I never asked the question, but it's part of it.
But I do wonder, and I know the answer to this because I work with young up-and-coming songwriters, you know, every week. And I know that the vast majority of the male songwriters do not sit there and think, oh, well, I can't sit there with an acoustic guitar because mm-hmm. otherwise people are going to think I sound like Lewis Capaldi or Sam Fender or whatever. They don't think this, whereas women are still, it's much, much better than it was, but there is still kind of thought of as a genre.
Oh, yeah, it's disgusting.
And the amount of hard work that you have to do to avoid those comparisons is just weary.
It is wearying.
I almost air punched the other week when Pete Phoebe's, who listened to my record, mentioned Scott Walker. I was like, yes, somebody actually listened to the record and heard the things that mean a lot to me and the influences that are deeply entrenched in my music, rather than just, you know, trot out the kind of lazy comparisons with another woman with a guitar or a woman with piano. And it's just, I am so fucking tired of being angry about it. I'm so tired of thinking about it. I'm so tired of second guessing myself. Like you say, you stopped yourself from making a record with an acoustic guitar. What happened? Why don't you make a record with an acoustic guitar?
I always resist it.
Wouldn't that be great? Good.
Yeah, I mean, I think I could now. But at the time, it was very much, I was trying to set out my stall. This is what I am. It was bad enough that I would turn up to gigs with massive bags full of equipment, you know, pedal board, loop pedal, had a giant megaphone, whatever else, and merch and whatever in these two massive bags, electric guitar on my back, you know, turning up to a show. And the sound engineer says, just you and an acoustic guitar, is it love? They're always trying to make me put the bags away somewhere. And it's like, why would I show up with all this shit if I didn't need it for the show? Are you kidding me?
And this is why as musicians we should talk about this, because
I
do think that there are a percentage of people that listen to your music and my music that won't know that this is our experience.
No.
And it's good for them to hear it and good for them to know
I guess
the obstacles and why maybe occasionally you might get a little bit angry about stuff online, because it's what I call microaggressions. They all build up, don't they?
Yeah.
It's exhausting over time.
It is exhausting. Yeah. And then something will just, you know, someone will say something relatively innocuous and then you just sort of snap. I mean, I don't snap at people online particularly, but I snap and I rage in my own home and then I'll write a sort of frostily polite response or whatever. But you know what, just recently, like in the last few weeks, it's occurred to me, and this is really slow, I don't have to reply to everyone who talks to me on the internet. I don't have to reply to everyone who emails me. If they're nice, I probably will. I'm not saying I'm going to ignore nice people, but occasionally I would just find myself sort of spending time being like polite back to someone who really doesn't deserve it. And I'm stopping that now. So that's quite nice.
I'm nodding my head here. Yeah. Boundaries are important.
Boundaries, like,
You can't win with everybody, and you can't convince everybody, and you can't change people's minds always.
And it's also not our job to do that.
I was about to say that. As much as we talked about this idea of a mission, or actually the mission is to just make some really bloody good records, right? Hopefully.
Yeah.
That's it.
And get through life and have a happy time when possible, I guess.
Yes,
I
when possible, like on balance, overall. On balance, maybe 40% of the time I'd settle for.
Yeah, that'd be fine. Yeah, that's not unreasonable. I did say before we started talking as well that our off-the-record conversation will be very different, and I hope that we get to have that as well. Because
it's just 150% more sweary.
Fuck yeah. Welcome to Correspondence Corner, where I pass the mic to a member of the audience and ask, what was the first album that changed your life? And what was the most recent?
Hi, my name's Darren. I live in Nottingham. I'm married with four children who are teenagers and adults. I work as a consultant in the energy industry. I don't know about change my life, but the first album that really got a hold of me and has still got a hold on me years, decades later, is The Wall by Pink Floyd, which a friend at school, you know, recorded onto a tape for me because I couldn't afford to buy my own copy of this double album. I do find it very hard to put into words the effect it had on me. It was and is an amazing album. You know, the music on it is incredible. The story or the themes or the concept that runs through it is mind-blowing. For me, when I first heard it when I would have been about 13, I couldn't really understand it and couldn't properly follow it. I didn't have the lyrics that I could read along with, so I was having to kind of interpret a lot of it, you know, myself. And so it was all very sort of vague and impressionistic, but it was wonderful. And then eventually, a few years later, I got to see the film version when that was shown on TV, you know, sometime in the mid-80s. And that sort of explained a lot of what it was about to me a bit more. And then a few years after that, when I started to have a bit of money of my own, I eventually bought a, you know, a copy for myself. And so then I could actually read the lyrics of all the songs in those pre-internet days. And, you know, and that gave me an even deeper understanding of it. But as a piece, I still think it's just a mind-blowing, amazing piece of music from beginning to end. And I still listen to it regularly, and I still love it just as much as I always have. The more recent one, again, it's not really life-changing in that sense, but the one that's kind of had the most impact on me recently is the album Cut and Stitch by Petrol Girls, which I heard because I saw their gig advertised in Nottingham in, it would have been probably in January this year. I hadn't heard of them before, but I was in that mood of, I'm going to go to loads of gigs, and even if no one else wants to come with me, I'm going to go. And they seemed like the sort of band I might like. So I went, and I was blown away by them, by their presence, by the things they had to say, and the actual kind of incandescent rage that they were sort of exuding on the stage, just completely energizing those of us that were there in the audience. It was just an amazing performance, and just incredibly powerful. And so I bought the album from the merch stand on the way out and listened to that the next day. And I was just, again, kind of, it's a completely different album to The Wall. It's got virtually nothing in common with it, apart from the fact that it's, you know, a band, a rock band that uses guitars. But it is so, again, so powerful in its own way, and so forthright and strident, and just full of really powerful messages that are articulated really well. And again, like it was in the live performance, you can kind of feel the rage and the passion when you sit and hear these songs. So I wouldn't say it's life-changing, but just sort of life-affirming, really, and just reminding me of the power of, you know, what music can do when it's properly harnessed and directed and used in that really skillful way. I love it.
Thank you, Darren. What brilliant choices. I know what I'm going to be listening to this week. So, what would you pick? I would love to include your voice in a future episode, and it's really easy to send me your recording. Just go to speakpipe.com/penfriend for my questions, and you can record and send your answers right there on the page. Now, back to my conversation with Catherine. What are you most proud of creating so far?
I think probably the second Anchoress record. As much as, like I keep saying, I'm kind of nervous about people hearing it. That's because I'm really, really proud of what I've done and I've built alone. And that was so important to me after my experiences in the industry to do a record on my own and to write and produce it myself. So no one could go, oh yeah, that really sounds like that person that you were in a room with once, because it's just exhausting. Yeah, you know how difficult it is to make a record and how much work is involved in that. So yeah, I'm really so proud of it. In a way that I hope, God, it sounds really depressing to say this, when I look back on my life, I feel like it will be, that will be an important record for me.
I don't think that's depressing. I think that's good.
It is a bit to be thinking about dying, isn't it? To be thinking, when I die, I hope that's the record that people remember. No one's going to give a flying fuck when I die about the records that I produce, probably. But
you may as well assume they will, because you're not going to know.
No, we won't know. We'll be on Spotify somewhere, won't it? Even if you can't, you can't buy it on vinyl anymore. Yeah, forever earning 0.002p.
Someone will eventually earn one whole pound from that. Woo! Oh, the conversations we could be having right now. Anyway, okay. What's the most challenging experience you've had as a musician?
Probably touring for 4 years or however long it was. It felt like 40 years. I loved touring with Simple Minds on so many levels, but it was really also nothing like what I had been prepared for and what I had expected. It was so physically and mentally grueling in a way that I felt deeply unprepared for. Mm. And it took me a long time to physically recover from that. Yeah, that was hugely challenging. I think mentally, because I've always gone through life kind of feeling like I'm up for any challenge. I keep myself really fit and healthy, and I love working hard. And then you're doing a 2.5-hour show every night, 6 days a week in different countries, and your body takes on a whole new level of exhaustion, along with the loneliness that comes with that. I used to call it 5-star loneliness, because we'd be staying in beautiful hotels, you know, like the Four Seasons or the Waldorf, places that, you know, you hear about and you think, I'm never going to stay there. But you're alone for a lot of the time. And that was I thought I was somebody like spending a lot of time on my own. But it's a very different kind of loneliness, because you've got these two really big extremes. I remember reading once an interview with Harry Styles, of all people, who captured this really well. And the contrast between standing on stage in front of tens of thousands of people and the adrenaline that comes from that, and then you immediately go back to an empty hotel room, and how that fucks with your brain chemicals in a way that's just not good for you. So that was really challenging for me. I'm sure I will go out and tour again, but I don't think I would ever do it on that scale in terms of that kind of marathon that they do. And I have huge respect for people that make that their kind of life's work. It's not for me. Not for my body.
And it's okay to admit that. It's okay. Like, I found it hard to admit that kind of thing out loud for a long time. I love playing. I love the bit where I'm on stage and I'm playing and people are listening and it's going well. And then all the rest of it, I'm cool with not doing that, you know. And even when I was touring with bigger bands, and there's, you know, like you say, that 5-star loneliness, which, if you don't use that as a song title or an album title, I'm going to nick it, because that's so good. Someone else may also steal it. It's brilliant. So I've experienced that too. And just saying in the, like, ridiculously posh hotel rooms. I was on tour with Tricky, and I was in Australia. I was just bawling my eyes out in this hotel room, not really understanding why, because it should be everything. We're told it's everything. It's the prize. I won the prize.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm nodding again enthusiastically. Yep, completely.
But also, you know, as exciting as it is to play for someone big who's got all these fans, they're not my fans. It's not my music. It's nothing to do with me at all. So yeah, we played to this like packed out tent at Fuji Rock Festival, had a brilliant time. And I did always enjoy the traveling and made the most of seeing the places. And I'm not an ungrateful person, but I shouldn't have to insist on this not being ungrateful thing. It's just really, really hard as well.
Yeah.
And that was only, you know, that was much shorter bout of touring than you did. Like, 4 years on the road is killer.
And I think, again, that's the thing about kind of having honest conversations with people who listen to your music, is like, I think in maybe 5 years ago, there wasn't that kind of direct contact with your fan base. So you wouldn't be able to express these things, and everyone can maintain that illusion of how touring is so glamorous and what amazing, like living the dream. Personally, I much more enjoy an honest conversation and saying, do you know what? You get to spend all your time with your family. You do your 9-to-5 job, whatever it is that you do that you may not feel is very interesting, but there are lots of bonuses and lots of gains from that versus the big sacrifices that touring musicians and crew make. You know, many of the crew are on the road for, you know, 30-40 years. It's a big sacrifice.
It really is. Yeah, it really is. It's really grueling. And I've never seen very much healthy behavior on tour. All the bands I played for, I would be the person who'd like want to go to bed or do some exercise or whatever, or have a night off drinking or whatever.
Well, I would say actually, you know, Simple Minds, because I've been doing it for so long, I guess probably that was all out of the system many years ago. You know, everyone was very kind of diligent and just kind of, you know, it's not a party bus, let's put it that way.
We've got an important show to do. That's the thing.
It's a job. And I think people forget that, you know, and my mission every day was to go on stage and do the best I could, and to replicate what I was there to do my job, to entertain people and to make the music sound as good as it possibly could. And that's a lot of pressure in front of, you know, 20,000-30,000 people every night.
And that's a long show as well. 2.5 hours is quite mega.
I lost a lot of weight actually just through sweating, because I was wearing a lot of like PVC and leather outfits, and I didn't really realize how much weight you can lose through just the sheer heat on stage.
Right.
It was quite difficult keeping my weight up on that tour, and we had to keep like taking my dresses in like over the course of months. It was not good. No. Not good.
God. And I also, there's this weird thing, and I don't mean to sound disrespectful to any audience member, but a lot of people don't sort of, like if you say, oh, I'm off to bed now or whatever on Twitter, or like I'm, or if you sort of express that you're a healthy person or you have other interests than, you know, booze, drugs and staying up all night or whatever on tour, they kind of act like that's a disappointment in some way. But if you fucked up the show because you were throwing up or whatever, couldn't do your job, they'd really hate that as well. So I just feel like there's this weird perception that, I always say it's like 15 minutes in the 80s. It was okay to just be obnoxious and do all the drugs and still have a massive career. And now you really can't do that. It's just, it's not respectful to the audience, is it?
I think it's so difficult because I kind of got two answers to that. One is I think there's still an appetite for the mythologizing of the rock and roll lifestyle. I think it's still out there. And also, what was my other point? The other side of that is agreeing with you, I guess, that it's, you know, people are paying a lot of money nowadays to come and see a show, and they have every right to expect the quality of that to be good. Equally, it's about, I guess, making them aware of all the psychological pressures that touring long term can bring. And now I completely understand why people drink on tour.
Yeah.
Who maybe didn't before. You know, I made the decision when I started touring to stop drinking completely, because I wasn't ever a particularly big drinker, but I knew that if I allowed myself to drink, that could be something I ended up doing every day, which is not good. So I think I did like 5 months of being teetotal the first time, which is probably, I mean, everybody on tour probably thought I was really boring. But, you know, whatever gets you through.
Well, that's the thing. And who actually cares what people think about boring or not boring? That's how I feel about it. I don't drink now. I did drink when I was on tour with various people 10 odd years ago, but never to the expense of a show, because I was being paid to play the bass. You know, I'm not gonna, you know, I wouldn't go to any other job drunk, you know. I just really wouldn't do that.
Yeah,
I wanted to keep that job.
There's a real dissonance, isn't there, with the music industry and kind of attitudes around alcohol and substances, that is at odds with this idea of it being a job or it being a profession.
Yeah.
And I think there's a long way to go on that still, but equally I think it's about being compassionate and understanding as well why many musicians turn to alcohol and drugs as a way to cope equally.
Oh, yeah,
I think
definitely.
It's really it's so complicated, I think, to come down on either side of it.
Oh yeah, totally. I just think that as someone who, like, I've never had issues with alcohol, I've never had issues with drugs, so it was relatively simple for me to go, do I want to, in the same way that you asked yourself, do I want to drink every day? Not really. That seems like a really bad way to live. I'm going to choose not to do that then. And that is, yeah. And then people can get very funny about that. I mean, even, you know, on or off the road, if you decide not to drink, or if you're someone who doesn't drink, it's kind of like you're judging them for drinking, when actually you just chose not to drink. So I've never had a problem being that person and just being like, this is nothing to do with you. I just don't want to. Anyway,
that's me too. I mean, I think I stopped drinking when I was 23 for 3 years, when I was really, really unwell, because I have celiac disease. So and it just became something I couldn't do anymore. I needed to prioritize my health. And I think from there on in, it's become really easy for me to just say, does this make my body feel worse or better? And I know I'm hugely privileged to be able to have that choice. It's not everybody does.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also a sign of maturity, I think, to be like, well, why do I feel so shit? Is there anything I can do about that? Okay, let's do those things, you know? I think I would have liked to tour with you, because I wouldn't be the only person going to bed early.
I do make jokes about, you know, when I tour again in the future, I'll probably only hire musicians that are straight edge.
Yeah, definitely. You've collaborated with lots of interesting people, done lots of cool shows over the years. Are there any particular career highlights that stand out to you at the moment?
Probably like supporting the Manic Street Preachers for the first time was one of those kind of pinch me moments. I can't even put into words how it still feels to be on stage with them. You know, I'm very lucky that every so often I get the call. It's like, do you want to come and do 3-4 songs at this festival or this show? And it's just, it feels like everything is worthwhile when, I can't explain it. I'm so ineloquent when it comes to them because I am still such a fan of them. And that's, I think that's such an important thing to get across too, is
yeah,
don't suddenly like cross over to the other side and become really cool about, you know, the bands that you loved when you were 10 inviting you on stage. It never stops being really cool. And it's even more cool when they turn out to be lovely, lovely people and everything that they profess to be. And that's quite unusual in this industry too.
I'm nodding very strongly now.
Yeah, it's not often that you meet your idols and aren't disappointed. So yeah, probably, you know, working with them, singing on their last album, duetting with James, and having James then return the favour, and he's on Anchor S 2, The Art of Losing, on 2 songs. So it's kind of come full circle, really. And I'm still pinching myself about it. And I hope that I never stop, because the moment that I become laissez-faire about it, I'll give myself a slap in the face. Don't be ungrateful.
Yeah, but isn't it lovely to have those moments and just be like, I completely understand what you mean about it. Like, it makes things worthwhile because you just get a little bit of a boost from those kinds of things, or a lot.
I often wonder if Nikki's got like a secret camera in my house, because every time I'm having a really tough time and there's awful shit going on in my life, I'll get a call or an email from them asking me to do something that makes me feel like it's worth carrying on.
Aww.
So I wonder if he's got like little secret spy camera, or like he's just really psychic and he's just like, yeah, Catherine needs a little, you know,
it's tuned into you
injection.
That's lovely. Yeah. I think that's super cool. That's super cool. Any other career highlights to share?
I feel bad because anyone I leave out is going to feel like they're kind of they are kind of being dissed. I mean, you know, most recently, obviously, putting out In Memory of My Feelings with Bernard, you know, to get that out after all that we kind of went through with it not coming out is a huge, just lovely feeling. And for all, but the nicest feeling of all, not, you know, having the number 14 chart position or anything like that, it's just the reactions from people listening to the record and feeling vindicated that we weren't mad after all, that these are great songs that we made. And that is why you do it, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and Bernard and I talked about that last week, about that being able to have that direct response to the music, which is such a beautiful thing now, especially this year when people aren't able to come to shows and things, and we're not able to do shows. So that's a lovely thing.
Yeah, we made a little trailer, actually. You know, we did one with all the press quotes, you know, from like the Times, Sunday Times, all of you know, the usual kind of magazines, and then we did one with all of the fan quotes.
Good,
because they are just as important as some, I say some journalists, I have great respect for a lot of music journalists, but you know, a fan's opinion is just as valid, and they've probably spent actually maybe more time listening and digesting the record. So we made a little trailer of all of those quotes.
That's lovely.
Which was nice.
Well, you know, that number 14 chart position, let's not skip over that, because that's wonderful. But that is a vindication of, one, the art being something that people want, and two, those people showing up for you. And as I said to Bernard, they have a choice to pay. They don't have to pay now.
Yep.
So they chose to do that, and they chose to do that for you. It's a vote of confidence in the project. I think that's beautiful.
There's a real resurgence of interest in beautiful physical products. Mm-hmm. And I think it's more important than ever. And it's certainly something I do with the Anchor S too, is put a lot of time and energy into making sure that if you're going to buy a physical product, that it's really fucking nice.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah.
No kind of cheap plastic kind of jewel case, or, you know, or card CDs. It's got to be something that has like a real value to it, and it's part of that. Going back to, I guess, what my mission and ethos is, it's like, I want to build a world that people can kind of step into, and the packaging is part of that. You know, I always want it to be high concept. I always work with the designer at the label really closely, to the point where they probably want to chop my head off by the end of it, because I have a whole vision for how it should look, and the fonts have to be taken from the Penguin Classics books, and the colour of the Pantone has to be exactly the same as this particular vintage edition of this. And it's about creating an object that is worth you spending your money on, when, as you say, you could just listen on Spotify for nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, I think all those little details make a massive difference. I feel the same way about all of this. And I've always tried to do that myself. And I think that it's in the same way that when you're producing a record, all those tiny decisions you're making and all that attention to detail and all of that, as you called it, control freakness, which I totally understand. All of those things lead to this thing that moves someone at the end of it. They don't necessarily know, or they probably don't know any of that happened. They don't need to know that. Or the audiences at a show don't need to know we had a shit drive there and whatever. They don't need to know all those things because they're coming for an escape. I mean, I try not to labour the point about the reality of touring, other than when I'm talking to other musicians, because I think obviously this podcast is about getting behind all of that stuff and showing our workings, I guess. But yeah, I think similarly with the artwork, all of that stuff, it combines together to create this powerful, moving thing. So yeah, it makes sense. I find it very strange when artists aren't involved in their artwork or don't see that that's an extension of the art. I mean, it's part of the art. Anyway, and you got leopard print 7 inches. So, I mean, that's super cool.
I've been lobbying for that for a while.
That's really cool.
I wanted to have a pitch disc, leopard pitch disc, but the price is just, it just would cost too much. And that's the other thing that's important to me, is not ripping fans off.
Yeah.
I made a real effort with Anchor S2 to make sure the price points were, especially many people at the moment haven't got a job or they're furloughed or they have job insecurity, and I wanted to make sure that we weren't offering a box set for £100, which is just ridiculous. So everything is, you know, under £27 for the like deluxe edition, and I think that's so important. And that's about going back to my mission and my ethos, and probably growing up with Mannix too, about knowing where I came from, knowing what the reality is of working people, and knowing that, you know, your expendable income is valuable. If they're going to spend it on me, I want them to feel like it was worth it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that I only get 18% of it anyway, but.
I don't know what my expression is right now, but yeah.
Let's not open that can of worms.
No, let's not. Again, the off the record conversation will be an interesting one. What is success to you, and have you ever experienced it?
I think for me, success is making work that you're proud of. That really is it. I think when I was younger, perhaps I was chasing some kind of affirmation externally. I think we all do that. I don't think there's many musicians or artists I've met that don't have something that they're looking to kind of compensate for, or a hole to fill in some ways.
Yeah,
to get all kind of Freudian on it. But that's changed and shifted for me over the years. And now, to be successful, I realise is, and this is from having spent a lot of time around Simple Minds as well, I think, and to hear them talk so eloquently about the kind of the troughs and peaks of a lifelong career, I think is really important. And it's so interesting because I'm teaching one day a week at the moment on a master's in music production, and so many of the students perceive success to be an upward trajectory. They have their goals for, like, in 1 year's time, I want to do this. In 3 years' time, I want to be doing this. In 5 years, this. And I sort of have to keep my mouth shut a little bit, because the realities of the industry are not always upwards. You might have a little victory and then you might have a setback. And I think it's much more realistic, and therefore for your own kind of sense of well-being, to think of success as being making work that you are happy with, because you have control over that. You don't have control over those external factors. Yeah. You don't have control over how your record will be received, whether it will get written about, whether it will get playlisted, because it's nothing to do with the quality of the work, as we all know now. It's a whole heap of other contextual factors, mostly money, to do with marketing money from labels. It's not an even playing field. So you would just drive yourself insane if your measure of success was, you know, how many records you sold, or, you know, chart positions, or even down to the fact that I don't read reviews either, because if I believe the good ones, I have to believe the bad ones too. It's a hard kind of thought battle that I have all the time to balance those two things, but, you know, that's what I try to do, is focus on the idea of success is just doing something that I am doing good work.
Yeah, I think it's really important, to talk about that. And the thing about the factors that we can't control is really important, because you could, yeah, you can drive yourself really bonkers thinking about, why can't I get on the radio? Why can't I, whatever.
Well, that's why I love working with other bands and artists so much. And now I'm producing other people. It's so lovely because you don't have to sweat that stuff anymore. Like, yeah. You just focus on making a good track or a good EP with them. And that is your job well done. And I find that really rewarding.
Yeah.
And also much less stressful and anxiety inducing.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing I love the most about making music is the puzzle. Writing a song to me is like putting a puzzle together. And then if the puzzle gets put together in a way that makes me really satisfied, then I know the song is done. And then the song's successful for me. And that's it. And then I record it and no one else really hears it till I put it out, because there's only me and my mix engineer and my husband who hears it, which is great. But then also quite scary because, you know, then it's out. But I think that's really interesting. And Tim was asking me the other day if I thought that a particular song off the new record was better than one off a couple of records ago. And I just said, I don't think of it that way. Like, that song solved that puzzle and this song solved this puzzle. And I don't compare them, you know, I can't compare them like that. But it's interesting. It's really good when I love to ask this question, because I'm always hoping for an answer like yours, because I don't believe it's about numbers or sales or anything. There's so many other things in between, like you're saying.
You would drive yourself nuts if that was the case. I remember having a conversation with Jed Grimes, the bass player in Simple Minds, and he was talking about, you know, the shape of his career over many years, and just that, you know, he's had huge success and then there's been times when he's been less busy, and it just gave me... And I know how lucky I am to have that perspective from them. And obviously not many young musicians starting out are exposed to that kind of perspective of the whole journey.
Yeah. I think being a career artist is something I want to be. So I want to keep putting music out as long as I can. That's it.
And that in itself will by definition involve peaks and troughs. And yeah, it's about how we get through those troughs. And I think as well, it's so difficult with social media because everybody's always amplifying the positive, amplifying their successes. You're very rarely going to see somebody going on Twitter kind of saying, do you know what, today I had a film sync fall through.
Yes.
Or today we decided we weren't repressing the record because not enough retail demand or something. You know, people don't amplify that.
No.
And I'm still really torn about how much you do and should be transparent about the whole process. I don't know, maybe it's worth probably me kind of straw polling some of the listeners to find out how, whether they actually want to know the ins and outs or not. I don't know if they do. Does it spoil it?
I think some will and some won't. Yeah, because yeah, like you say, it could spoil it for some people if they want this mythology part of it. But you know, we are humans as well, and it's up to us to share what we think is useful. And speaking of the listeners, who do you perceive as being your audience now, and how has that changed over the years?
It's interesting, actually, because obviously Spotify stats kind of throw a whole new light on that. But I had a great conversation with someone yesterday about this that was talking about how platform specific it is. Mm. So, for instance, Spotify might be much more skewed towards men, but that doesn't mean that your gigs, you have a much more kind of equal gender split, or you have much more women coming to your gigs, because everything is contextual.
Mm.
I don't think I've ever really thought about who listens to my music, because I kind of, I never had that kind of moment where I was like, oh, I really want girls from 16 to 25 to be buying my music. It's not really a kind of demographic so much as just people that enjoy, I guess, a rich kind of in-depth experience. I don't know. Who are they? Who are you people?
That's kind of what I mean. I didn't mean it in terms of demographics, actually. Just in, like, what kinds of people, like, that I imagine they are thoughtful people who read books, and some of them like the Manic Street Preachers and some of them like Simple Minds, and some of them were your people before that, you know?
Yes and no, because I've had some really interesting experiences where I've been heckled on stage for making any kind of political comments about Brexit or the Tory party. And you would think, wouldn't you, that somebody listening to my music who's coming to a show of mine would be perhaps more likely to be left-leaning, perhaps more likely to be a Remainer. And it takes all sorts, is all I can
say. They heckled you at your own show.
Yes.
Do not do that, people listening. Do not shout at her on stage. She's busy.
I enjoy a good debate.
On stage, though.
But I think it's a really important moment, actually, yeah, to kind of stop and think, do you know what, actually, I can't dictate who listens to my music and I can't dictate what they think. And they might enjoy my music but have a different political view from me. Yeah. And do you know what, that's okay.
It's definitely okay. I think the shouting at the gig is the thing that's not okay. I think that is the height of rudeness, personally.
No, I still, you know, I still cuss out Margaret Thatcher on stage when I play Confessions of a Romance Novelist, which is a song that name checks her.
Yeah.
I'm not going to stop doing that because a few people might disagree with me in the audience. They are welcome to disagree,
of course,
vociferously with me, and enjoy the song still. That's fine.
Yeah, yeah. If we can agree and still be in the same room together. Sorry, we can disagree. We can also agree and be in the same room together. That's probably a bit nicer. I don't know. I think, yeah, if everything was completely unchallenging, that would be incredibly boring. That's not how we learn and grow, is it?
Yeah, she says the woman who just put a quote from Donald Trump at the front of her new video. Because, of course, I just like to be so neutral about politics.
Well, yes. I don't think being neutral is the thing at all. No, it's just, I think, accepting, like you're saying, that accepting that people who listen to your music aren't necessarily going to be into your politics is fine.
I should qualify that to say I was not supporting Donald Trump with the quotes at the beginning. It was his famous grab them by the pussy quote. So in case anyone was thinking I was a secret Republican.
Very secret.
There are women who vote for Donald Trump, though.
It's bizarre.
Which I find quite, it's like Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah, it's pretty, yeah. It feels good to have a bit of hope at the moment after that result on the weekend, though. I've got to say, it has such a far-reaching effect on the world.
But don't want to jinx it, though.
No.
I don't. I still don't quite 100% believe it.
Yeah. I think some fucked up things could happen in the next 2 months as well. But let's not go down that route.
And there's nothing like a narcissist who's been found out for destroying and sabotaging everything in their path.
Yeah. Yay. Okay.
What an optimistic conversation this morning.
It's all right. I'll cut it out. No. How has the internet impacted your career over the years? And what's your current relationship with smartphones?
See, I have no experience of being a musician without the internet. So it's quite a strange question for me. Because I don't think I would have had access to having a career without the internet. I kind of caught on to the very last heydays of MySpace. And that was responsible for me getting my first booking agent and manager. And I think just the internet kind of opened doors and kind of democratized the access to people in the industry in a way that, you know, you could drop someone an email.
Yeah.
You could send them a message through Facebook. And that, so I have no other experience of what it would be like to try and carve a path out without those tools. I have a pretty healthy relationship with my smartphone with regards to, like, I really enjoy interacting with my fans and sharing the process of making records. And at the moment, I feel like I'm really lucky in that I haven't kind of hit that bump of feeling like I'm online too much or I need to come off for a bit. And I've taken myself offline when I've needed to in the past, you know, for weeks at a time or whatever, or just, I feel like I'm able to kind of police myself pretty well when I need a break.
That's good. That's really good. Some people find it really hard to do that. And I think some people also, the reason I asked this question, because everyone has a different experience of it. I think a lot of artists don't use it in a very smart way. And I think that you use it in a very smart way. Because I see what you're doing. And I, you know, and I have my ways of doing things too. And I'm like, oh, okay, she's doing that. That's cool. And I know that all that stuff takes a lot of work and a lot of time. And it's all done really well with care and looks very pro and approachable as well and all that stuff. So I appreciate how you use it. And I guess I was just checking in to make sure that you're also having a break, because it's really important that we're not stuck to our phones all day if it's making us sad. If we're cool with it, if we're fine, that's fine. But if we're not, turn it off. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I have spent the last week, to be honest, online an awful lot more than I would normally, but it was launch week,
yeah.
So that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, it's important to put the work in then. But, there, you know, there are peak times when people are online in the mornings and then after work, so you can kind of divide up your day a little bit. But no, I feel okay with it at the moment, she says, smashing her iPhone against her head.
Well, good. I love seeing people's reaction to your stuff as well, because there's a lot of people making a lot of things and we're all trying to, you know, get people's attention, hence the name of this podcast. You know, we're all sort of trying to do that in a hopefully holistic way, and also, you know, offering people things of value. And I'm really glad that's working for you. It's really good to see that.
Thank you. I think it's also, you know, another aspect of being a musician that really interests me. Mm. It's not just making the music. I love learning a skill, learning how to do something, observing, researching, and then practicing something. And social media is as much a part of my music career as making the music itself. You know, I even at one point was doing consultancy work for one of the big management companies, teaching them how to use Facebook, because it had come to people's attention that I was quite good at that. It wasn't like I hadn't been to a course or anything to do that. I had just watched and dissected what other people were doing. And like anything I do in life, I want to do it well. And so it's really nice to hear that it looks like I know what I'm doing.
Well, I often feel like I'm like this calm swan on a pond with my legs flapping underneath. So I can imagine you might sometimes feel that way too. But it comes across really well, which is the point, isn't it? That's the point of it.
Yeah, there's always that moment on a Sunday where you've forgotten that you scheduled a post, and then you've just posted something manually yourself, and then the scheduled post goes up and you have to delete the other one. I still, you know, it's not a calm ship here. Yeah. So I do make mistakes, because it is done by me and it is done by hand.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what it should be. I mean, it's like having too much distance from that stuff as an artist doesn't make sense to me. It just doesn't make sense because it's not very, you know, real. And I just think that it's not just marketing. Of course it is marketing, but it's actually having a conversation with people who are interesting, who have interesting lives and who also happen to like your music. And I think we can all learn from each other and benefit from that in so many ways. So if you're not anything to do with that, I just find that to be weird.
You know? Yeah, it's the connection, the payoff for me completely. Yeah. I mean, you know, none of us is making huge amounts of money out of music anymore. So there has to be some payoff in other respects. And for me, seeing people's enjoyment of a track or an album is the payoff.
Yeah.
And you can't get that unless you're on social media. So
yeah, exactly. I had something really clever I was going to say, but damn it, it's gone. I could just say that anyway and with nothing in my head. Have you ever heard of a podcast called Creative Pep Talk?
I've not, no.
I'll send you a link because I think you might really enjoy it. With all the hours free you have in your day, you could just listen to this as well. But it's really good because the host, Andy J. Pizza, talks about the hero's journey quite a lot, the Joseph Campbell thing. And he's talking about it in the context of when you make a piece of art, that's great and everything. But this stupid maxim that good art sells itself is absolute horseshit. We need to realize that. And then the second part of the journey is bringing the art back to the audience. So you go on the journey to find yourself, create the art, the meaningful art, and then you bring it back to your community. Of course, we're finding our community. It's not a ready-made community necessarily waiting for this wonderful piece of art we've made if we haven't already got an audience. But then, yeah, the second part of the quest is finding those people. And when you just make something and expect it to do stuff for you, that's when you're missing out on that amazing second part of it. And I really love it for those reasons too. You know, and there's not enough randomness in life, especially when we're all stuck indoors. And the randomness can come from speaking to those audience members too.
Yeah, and I think that's where I've been really lucky, obviously, with my collaborations, is that they have, in some sense, kind of speeded up that process of finding the audience, because you're able to make those connections with those people who are similar-minded and like-minded. And I'm, you know, hugely lucky in that regard.
Yeah.
So when people ask me, why do you collaborate? It's like, well, that's sort of why. Well, it isn't why consciously, but it's why it's really important to collaborate. Mm. It's because that's how you reach out to different audiences that you wouldn't perhaps naturally be exposed to.
Mm, definitely. Yeah. That's why I was asking about your audience, because it's an interesting mix. If you go, okay, there could be, again, not at all dismissing the fans of the Anchoress alone. There's also, you know, potentially Ed Harcourt fans, Manic Street Preachers fans, Simple Minds fans. And then there's a crossover of all of those people because, hello, people like all sorts of different kinds of music, not just one band. Mm-hmm. I just find that to be so interesting for myself as well, because I have like New Model Army fans and Levelers fans and then my fans alone and then whoever else and people from the internet and people from this tour and whatever. And then you get them all in a room and it's just like, wow, we've somehow pulled all these people in from all these different places and they care about the thing we're making. How amazing and magical is that? Love that.
I can imagine seeing you on tour, support any of the artists you support over the last few years, that you're going to win people over. And that's a job well, that's, you know, you're doing your job well when you're kind of taking some of that fan base with you into your world afterwards.
That is really nice.
Like, you know, I'd like to hope that I've done that too with Simple Minds and the Manics to some extent. And it's a pat on the back from them saying, we liked enough of what you did when we saw you open the show that we're going to come with you on your journey.
Exactly. So people listening, if you saw either of us play somewhere supporting another band and you liked it, always tell us, because we love hearing that, right? It's so nice because it's, yeah, like you say, I did a good job. I got myself across in the way that I liked. It landed on someone in a way that they liked, and then they're going to come and support me in future. It's amazing.
Yeah, because being the support act is so difficult, isn't it? It's yes. So, it can be so depressing.
Yep.
It can
oh,
be.
Oh, yeah. It can be amazing, and it can be just the worst, the yeah. absolute worst.
Yeah.
And you never know which it's going to be.
Yeah, talk about stressful.
Yeah, super stressful. Yeah. I thought it was really cool that you got to, because you got to support Simple Minds as the anchoress as well as yep. playing with them, which must, I remember seeing that and thinking, she is a hard worker, because that's a lot of work in
although
one night.
I wasn't actually on stage, so that was on the acoustic tour in
right.
2017, I think, or was it 2018? I'm not sure which year it was, because my years all got jumbled up. So I wasn't in the main core band for the acoustic tour, because it was acoustic.
Yes.
So I did my support set with them, and then I would come back on stage for the final three songs and the encore. So it wasn't quite as hard work.
Yeah,
Although, to be honest, I probably would have preferred to have stayed on the whole time, because it's quite boring sitting backstage while people are playing. It's like, what are you going to do? You're just waiting to go back on at the end. I would have been quite happy just to stay on and do some stuff.
Be more useful.
Yeah, make myself useful and tidying up the dressing room instead.
But that's really nice, though. It's such a nice thing, because that's quite a rare thing for a band to do, is to invite their, you know, someone who's played with them or plays with them to support as well, possibly because it's so much hard work. I don't know. But I'm glad that worked out.
You know, Jim and Charlie have just been so supportive of me, and we're just that was a real surprise to be asked to do that.
Yeah. That's lovely.
It was Katie Tunstall on the European dates, and it's obviously, you know, she's had such a huge career, and then I did all the UK dates, and I sort of felt, how am I supposed to live up to that?
Well, the point is, you're not, are you? You're just supposed to be you. That's the point.
Yeah, I know.
You're not living up to anything.
Yeah, I have to tell myself this whenever I play live. You can only be yourself. You cannot be someone else.
It took me a long time before someone said to me, when someone asks you to do something, don't like second guess it. Because I would be doing that, you know. They've asked you because they want you, because they could have asked anybody else. And so I think it was when I was on tour with a band, and maybe I was wondering why they'd asked me or something, or having a crisis of confidence. And this guy was just like, yeah, you're here because they wanted you to do it, not just because you were available, you know. They wanted you. So just have that in your mind, be a bit more confident. And that really helped me, actually. Not that you need any more confidence. It just reminded me of that story.
I would say I do. And this is probably something that people don't know about me, is that I am very not confident about playing live.
Okay.
Despite having done, I don't know, it must have been more than 1,000 shows with Simple Minds in the end. I still find live to be the most challenging thing that I do. I still get terrible, not stage fright, but nerves, adrenaline rushes. I still find it really, it's scary.
Yeah.
I want to do a really good job, and that makes me nervous every single time.
Yeah. Once you get going, are you okay?
Well, you mean get going on stage or get going on the tour?
Or just on the stage on that show?
So yeah, maybe after about 45 minutes, I can kind of stop shaking. It takes a while. But also once you've got into a tour, like once you've done it sort of like, you know, 6-7 nights in a row or something like that, it gets a little bit easier. But yeah, that's probably something people don't know about me, is that I suffer from terrible anxiety around performing. And I make a joke of it often when I'm on stage, but if you were up close to me, you would see my hands are actually shaking and sweating. And it's difficult, because I kind of struggle with it a bit in terms of thinking, you know, am I actually relieved a little bit at the moment that we can't play live? Because it kind of takes that a huge anxiety out of my life for a little bit.
Yeah. Do you think there's enough of a payoff for you in the, you know, the feeling you get after playing or during, or the result of, you know, result of the show?
I hope there's enough of a payoff for the people coming to see the show. I don't think I will ever have enough payoff personally. I don't think it will ever be something that I'm naturally going to prefer to being in the studio. But I'll do it if people want me to do it and there's demand there to see it. And that's a really unfashionable thing to say, isn't it? Because you're supposed to say, I love playing Live with Simple Minds because the pressure wasn't on me.
Yeah.
And I love being part of something, part of a band. Basically, my entire musical career is about me realizing that I would have been a lot happier if in a band. It's too late now. Obviously, the band would have broken up as well. none of us would be speaking by now. But yeah, my entire career would have been a bit different, I think, if I'd shared the load a bit more.
I feel like if I had started a band 10 years ago with my project, it would have broken up and we wouldn't be speaking now. And also they would have let me down in so many ways or something. I feel naturally so protective over the music I want to make that I catastrophize about what would go wrong if other people were sort of involved, which might not be the healthiest thing, but it's working out for me, so it's fine. I have no regrets on that front.
No, I can concur with much of what you're saying, I think. But there are those moments, like, so on the new single, Show Your Face, James Dean Bradfield plays some guitar, and I just remember that moment of getting back the file from him and just being like, not only, wow, that's incredible, but also thank God I don't have to do that, solve that particular part of the puzzle too.
Yeah.
It's just nice. For a moment, you can feel a little bit like you're in a band with someone else, that, you know, that other people's creative input can kind of lift something up to the next level.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, and to be clear, the creativity part of it is an incredible thing. And that's why, you know, when I see a real band playing together and they're really good and it really all works, I just think that's just like the best thing. So there's a band called Hope and Social from Leeds who are friends of mine. And whenever I see them play online or whatever, or in person, and whenever they release something, I just think that is so much like, it's so much bigger than the sum of its parts. And that's what collaboration can be. And it's so beautiful. But I just think, God, how hard must it be to keep that going? And all the different people with all the different missions and dreams and pressures and stuff. It just seems like a massive headache to me. But it's great when it works.
Well, that's what was so great about playing in Simple Minds was that feeling, too, you know, being on stage with these consummate musicians. And there's me, who is at best adequate, you know, and just the sound that we could make together as a group.
Yeah.
Being a part of that, it feels like being like a limb in a kind of body that kind of with a beating heart, and it's just such an incredible feeling. Maybe that's why I develop such bad stage fright when I do it on my own, because I no longer feel safely a part of that well-functioning body that's just a finely tuned machine. To go back then to sitting on your own on stage is quite scary.
Yeah, I feel sick before I play. Even if I'm doing, I did a live stream last week and I was like, why do I feel sick? This is ridiculous. Like, and I've done those for a long time. So it's not that I feel like I'm playing to no one and, you know, all of that stuff where you don't get any feedback. I'm fine with that part, actually. I think I used to just sort of put it off at shows in person by like fiddling with the merch or whatever. Like I'd do something and there's sort of nothing to distract me when I'm doing one at home.
Have you ever delved into why that is, though, the chemicals behind it? Because I found that quite helpful to me thinking about it being a productive anxiety. So the idea that our adrenaline is there to make us alert, to keep us sharp and focused, and that's what you get a rush of before you go on stage. It also has the side effect of making you feel nauseated, which is the feeling. So rather than saying, I feel nervous, you should be saying, my adrenaline is pumping. My adrenaline is priming me to go on stage.
Okay.
Whilst it doesn't stop you feeling sick, it helps you to kind of rationalise the feeling, I guess.
Yeah.
And to know that it's just a chemical reaction that's happening in your body that's there to serve a purpose.
Right.
God, I sound like a doctor, don't I?
It's that's like... good. I believe everything you just said.
But it's true. That certainly helps me a lot to think about why I was feeling like, you know, why do I feel like that before I go on stage or perform? And it's like, well, I feel like that for a reason.
Yeah. And I didn't really get it when I was playing with other people, you know, to packed out places. Because again, it's not my music. They weren't judging my music. They just, whatever, if I was doing my job well, then I was doing my job well. And that's what I was there for. But when it's like, words I have written, especially when it would be worse when I was supporting someone. So I supported Griff Rhys and it was amazing, of course, supporting Griff Rhys. And I remember stepping up to the stage in this sudden surge of that, adrenaline and nausea, because it mattered to me. That's the thing, it matters. It mattered to me that the audience who had paid to come and see him didn't think I shouldn't have been playing, basically.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think you're right, probably does serve a good purpose.
Another helpful thing that someone once said to me was, what are you worried about? And then I would say messing up. And then she said to me, what would happen if you messed up?
Yeah.
And she said, think about some of your favourite bands or artists that you've seen when they mess up on stage, and what do you think? And I was thinking about Rufus Wainwright fucking up at the Royal Albert Hall when he's playing a solo piano show, and how much the audience loved it. It was like the best moment in the show, and it's the most memorable moment in the show. So also kind of mentally preparing yourself for the presence of imperfection, and also realising that actually that is something that the audience quite like. The humanity of a fuck up, that they don't expect you to be perfect. It's not a grade 8 piano recital.
exactly, yeah.
And that those are kind of been the two things. You can tell I've had a lot of therapy here.
Yeah, that's great though.
CBT orientated thinking around anxiety, because it's, you know, this is a chemical reaction. This is why it's happening. It serves a purpose. And then also, what are your worst fears? What would happen if your worst fears happened? Mm. How would this, let's play this out. In a logical conclusion, would it be that bad? No.
Yeah, no, never. And our mutual friend Mark Burrows actually helped me massively with this years and years and years ago, 2013 or so. I remember because it was such a big thing. And he said to me, if everything was falling down around your ears, you've got those songs. And I was just like, what a lovely thing to say to someone. What a lovely compliment. Because he's right. Like, people are interested in what they're interested in the whole thing you're presenting, not did I play that chord right, or did I sing that note a tiny bit out of tune or whatever. They're experiencing it as a sound that's the whole thing. And so if I'm pleased with the songs I have written, which I am, then there shouldn't really be an issue with the whole thing being presented in a certain way. And so after that really was much easier. And even if like I had a cold or something, I'd know, well, I'm standing here in a room with these people, and we're having this unique exchange, and that's what live music is. And no one's going to be like, well, you shouldn't have played if you've had a bit of a cold or whatever. They don't care.
Well, that will be it in the future, won't it? Because none of us will be playing if we've got a bit of a sore throat anymore. Because it...
I hadn't thought of that. That's a very good point.
The upside of the world pandemic is no more playing if you're feeling unwell.
Yeah, I guess so. Right, you've talked to me for ages, which is very lovely and kind of you. But I'm going to wrap it up, because then I'm going to ask you some questions I ask everyone at the end. Which pieces of your own work would you recommend as a gateway for new listeners?
Probably the first would be my most recent single, which came out last week, Show Your Face by The Anchorist, from the forthcoming second album. I think probably the most recent collaborative album I did with Bernard, In Memory of My Feelings, which is out under the name Bernard Butler and Catherine Ann Davies, or Catherine Ann Davies and Bernard Butler, actually. I don't know why we did it that way. It should have been alphabetical. I think I lobbied for it to be alphabetical. Doesn't Kill You, off the debut album. And then maybe my duet with the Manics, Dylan and Caitlin, from their album Resistance is Futile.
Lovely. What's your next creative adventure?
Well, I've already started making Anchorus album 3, partly because of lockdown. There's not much else to do, is there? But I'm also producing a couple of artists at the moment I'm really excited about working with. A singer-songwriter called Tegan Mendez, who is incredible. She doesn't know how good she is. And I'm producing her debut EP as well. So I've got fingers in lots of pies, as per usual. There's also a new Dark Flowers record coming out. I think that's going to be early next year.
Great.
I always forget all the different things I'm doing. So apologies to anyone I've forgotten that I'm working with that I haven't mentioned. And Bernard and I are probably going to be, you know, at some point starting to do some more writing, and maybe we'll do it all again in 10 years' time.
That sounds good. It's funny because you mentioned MySpace earlier. I'm pretty sure that's where I first read that you were working with him all those years ago. Yeah. And then there's sort of a thing where a few years ago, and you'd put out the Anchorist album 1, and I thought, that's not with Bernard Butler. What was this Bernard Butler thing? Will we ever hear it? And we have, which is great. So well done. Well done for, just sticking to it, working hard, carrying on, war of attrition.
The little album that could is what we call it.
I love that. Brilliant. What is it about music that keeps you coming back to do it?
Well, that's such a great question. I think for me, right from being a child, music is the thing I feel the most keenly and extremely. It's like a drug for me. I remember being about 4 or 5 and just sitting there listening to Simon and Garfunkel with my mum and crying at Bridge Over Troubled Water. And the ability for music to manipulate my emotions, I think, is something that I'm quite addicted to, and probably something I'm trying to replicate myself on some level. To capture, it's like capturing the emotion, isn't it, in a glass jar and selling it to people on the internet. and hoping the glass doesn't smash in the face. There's a metaphor.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today. Congratulations on the latest album. I'm excited for the new one and all the other ones that are coming out.
All of the other ones. It's kind of confusing, isn't it, actually? It's like, which album is coming out? Which has come out? Which is coming out? When's it coming out? So In Memory of My Feelings, Catherine and Davies and Bernard Butler, out now. Really difficult to find, though, because we sold out of vinyl and the CD is just being repressed at the moment. And then The Art of Losing by the Anchoress is coming out next March 5th, 2021. But we are releasing a single a month until then. So you can pre-order it now from my website.
Excellent. Check the show notes for all these links, people. Thank you so much, Catherine. It's lovely to chat Laura. After so long.
Thank you.
I hope you agree that now would be a brilliant time to start exploring Catherine's work. And to help you in this endeavour, I've created a deluxe show notes page on my website with links and videos. Head to penfriend.rocks/Catherine for that. If this is the first episode of Attention Engineer you've tried, you might be interested in episode 22, starring Bernard Butler. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to help me continue to make this 100% independent show, there are three quick things you can do. 1. Subscribe. 2. Leave a star rating. 3. Write a short review on Apple Podcasts to let people know they should give Attention Engineer a try. And if you'd really like to impress me, why not share this podcast with a friend? Just send them along to my website, penfriend.rocks, and as a thank you, I'd love to send you both some free music. All you have to do to get both of my recent singles speedily delivered to your inbox is enter your email address. Big love to my Correspondence Club, who power the making of new music and podcast episodes through their subscriptions. Thank you so much. If you'd like to see what all the fuss is about, head to my website to browse free and paid monthly and annual tiers with all sorts of fun member perks included. Join me next week for my conversation with songwriter, bassist, vocalist and award-winning art director Alicia Gaines from Chicago band Ganza. Till then, take care.